in a small green-bricked, brightly lit room. On one side, where the mirror was to be pitted, was a row of wooden chairs, and on the other, a stainless steel table with 5 leather straps and 2 wrist restraints.
"It's where the death row boys get the needle," Hank explained. "The witnesses can watch him die, but he ain't gonna see them. All he can see is his own reflection, and the light going out of his own eyes."
Butterflies circled Ron's stomach, and for the next fortnight all he could think about were what stories the mirror he created would be able to tell. When child murderer Bobby Dalgleish's execution date was set for a month's time, Ron invented an excuse to contact the prison, and lied, suggesting the mirror might have a near-invisible hairline crack in need of urgent repair. And giving it a detailed once-over in a convincing performance, Ron asked if he could remain there to witness the execution. The suspicious chief eyed him up and down. It wasn't a request he received often. But concluding Ron was innocuous, consent forms were signed and countersigned, and Dalgleish's execution was the first of 62, Ron observed, over the next 2.5 decades. Ron gained no pleasure or thrill from watching a state-sanctioned murder. It was the ability to covertly watch someone at their most vulnerable that enticed him. Executions weren't a weekly or even monthly occurrence in Texas, meaning Ron travelled the country seeking them out. Sometimes he'd pose as a long-lost member of a victim or perpetrator's family, needing closure or to offer support. On other occasions he pretended to be working as a reporter for an obscure small-town publication with a make-believe vested interest in the execution. Not every appointment went the way Ron intended. When in Alabama he discovered the observation room contained a window and not a mirror, he immediately walked out. In Arizona he felt short-changed when a curtain was drawn as soon as the lethal injection was administered. But over time, the criteria for witnessing an execution became tougher, the identity checks more rigorous, and Ron more frequently refused entry. When his employers shut up shop in the recession, Ron's savings and farm insurance payout funded his travels across America, and eventually he found himself as the oldest guest at a decrepit backpacking hostel in Los Angeles. The owner had made it known she'd happily sell for a bargain price, so Ron used the last of his savings to purchase his first home since the farm. Although Ron didn't need to interact with people, he learned to appreciate being surrounded by them, and sometimes he'd sit in his office with the door ajar, going about his hostile business as the voices on the other side went about theirs. Ron had yet to meet a woman who would make any impact on his life. That was until the night he sat inside a private peep-show booth at a strip club, and instantly fell for a beautiful dancer called Savannah, as she moved before him from behind a 2-way mirror.
"You spied on Savannah while she was in her bathroom," Nicole began. "That's disgusting. Jesus, Ron, she trusted you."
I wasn't spying. Someone had to look out for her," Ron replied, his voice trembling. She was vulnerable and she needed me."
"She was only vulnerable because of people like you taking advantage of her."
I didn't take advantage. I just needed to be close to her."
"Yeah, I can see how close you've come,"
Nicole replied, and gave a disgusted glance at the discarded tissues lying by Ron's feet.
You're sick."
I'm sorry. Please don't tell her," replied Ron,
and Nicole recognized angst in his eyes. He moved towards her, but a wary Nicole temporarily forgot about her bruising, and reached down to grab a piece of the broken perfume bottle, and held it in front of her like a weapon.
"Why shouldn't I tell her? Because she'd see you for what you are, a dirty, grubby little pervert."
I'm not."
"What you've done isn't normal, Ron. Surely you can see that.
And Savannah needs to know." "But if you tell her, she'll never come back. I'll never see my—"
Ron's brow wrinkled, and he clasped his hand over his mouth.
"See your what?"
asked Nicole. When Ron didn't reply, the penny dropped for Nicole. Chapter 81. The thumping beat of electronic dance music blared from 6 large speakers surrounding a DJ's booth, as around 600 hostelers danced and drank across the floodlit Santa Monica beach. Partygoers had walked or been bussed in from Los Angeles' 6 hostels in Venice, Santa Monica, and Hermosa Beach to mark the end of the summer with an all-night celebration. As a rule, L.A.'s vast beaches were legally out of bounds by 10 p.m., but tonight was an exception, courtesy of a tourism initiative to promote the city's hostels as places to stay rather than to use as a stopover between more traveler-friendly regions like San Francisco or San Diego. The L.A. Tourism Board and hostel managers collaborated to fund 2 photographers and a film crew to take pictures and video footage for a print and online viral video promotional campaign. Marshals handed guests wristbands, coloured to match their respective hostels, and keep unwelcome gatecrashers out. A scout was sent to find the most attractive of the travellers to appear in the forthcoming promo material, but Matty and Declan politely refused the offer when approached, and relocated to a quieter section of the beach. Declan tucked into a second cheeseburger with all the trimmings, while Matty lay on the sand, propped up by his elbows, staring into the distance. He kept his exhaustion to himself.
"Do you reckon we should start thinking about moving on?" asked Declan. "Finish your food first."
"I meant leaving L.A.
"Why, you love it here. We've made friends here."
"I know, it's been a blast. I just thought you might want to try somewhere else."
"Nah," said Matty, shaking his head. "If you're happy, I'm happy. And this is a good place to be."
Declan grabbed a plastic cup of beer and a bottle of water for Matty from an ice bucket behind him.
"Water? Gee, thanks,"
sniffed Matty, although even the thought of alcohol passing his lips made him nauseous.
"That's good for you. It flushes out your bad toxins. And it hasn't flushed you away."
They paused to stare at 2 girls dancing ahead of them.
"You're losing your touch," smiled Matty. "Look at the blonde one. She's been giving you the eye all night. Once upon a time, you'd have been there like a rat up a drain pipe. Go over and talk to her."
"You don't have to tell me twice. Are you coming?"
"No, I'm going to get arseholed on Evian."
"Stay out of trouble," replied Declan,
and wandered over towards the girls as Matty watched.
"I'll be with you in spirit."
He smiled. Chapter 82.
"Oh, good God. Tell me her baby isn't yours,"
Nicole said to Ron, as they stood amongst the shards of broken mirror and glass in Savannah's bathroom. The piece she'd used to fight off any potential attack remained in her grasp. She genuinely hoped to hear a firm no, but Ron's shamed silence gave Nicole her answer.
"You drugged and raped her and made her pregnant, didn't you?"
she asked quietly.
"I didn't drug her. I found her when she needed help," replied Ron. "Don't use that word. I didn't rape anyone. I love her."
4 months earlier, Savannah's motel. Ron sat in an armchair in the corner of Savannah's motel room, drumming his fingers across the arm, watching her as she slept under a tartan quilt. Whatever drug had been slipped inside her water bottle in the strip club had had the desired effect, but not for the perpetrator. At first, Ron wondered why anyone would want to do that to the girl he adored. But as he stared at her inert body, he began to understand. From his usual seat in the shadows at the back of the club, Ron knew Savannah wasn't like the other girls she shared a stage with. Those girls' eyes betrayed the sexuality they were trying to promote. They were filled with either pretense or desperation. Savannah was different, and from the moment she'd sashayed past him in her black bra and panties and caught his eye, he knew they'd just shared something special. However, his frustrating inability to engage with strangers meant he chose not to interact with her, and instead he pulled his baseball cap down towards his thick eyebrows and sunk ever deeper into his chair. During a fortnight of frequent return visits, Ron watched as Savannah contorted her supple limbs around a pole, either on stage or in a back room surrounded by peep show customers, who could sit in private booths masturbating behind two-way mirrors. He'd spent close to $3,000 getting to know her body better than she knew her own. That night, 4 months ago, the stars had aligned and their worlds collided. Ron could barely believe his eyes when Savannah stumbled in front of the car as Paik picked him up from the club. Together they lifted her into the vehicle and laid her out across the back seat, and when Paik found her motel key inside her handbag, they drove her back to her room and put her to bed. Ron purposefully failed to mention he knew who the girl was, but offered to stay with her until morning to make sure she was okay. Savannah had been unconscious for around an hour and a half before Ron hesitantly plucked up the courage to approach her side of the room. He knelt by the bed and tentatively ran his rough fingertips through her soft hair. Gradually he moved his mouth closer to hers and gently kissed her lips. Then he slowly slipped into her bed, unbuckled his belt, slid down her shorts, and guided himself inside her. In less than 20 seconds he climaxed. By the time Savannah awoke in the morning, Ron had left, and Paik had taken his place, fast asleep in the armchair. And in the back of the cab, returning back to the hostel, Ron was immersed in the flavor of love for the first time in his life. Today, Nicole shuffled uncomfortably from foot to foot, finding it difficult to comprehend that Ron couldn't see his actions had been despicable towards the woman he claimed to love. "So what do you call it when a woman is unconscious and can't say no to sex?" she continued. "Reluctance?"
"It wasn't like that. Savannah's so beautiful, and I'd sit at the back of the club watching her dance, and she had this look in her eyes like she was alone, like me. We understood each other."
"Ron, this is all in your head. Can't you see that? I knew you were a bit weird, but this... Christ!"
"I'm not weird," exclaimed Ron. "I told you, I love her."
"Love isn't an excuse to rape someone."
"She's been let down so many times before. If you tell her, you'll destroy her. Please let her think I'm her friend, for Savannah's sake."
"That is the last thing you are."
Nicole and Ron reached a stalemate, neither budging from their respective positions. But Nicole knew she held all the cards, only she was unsure how to play them.
"What do you want me to do?"
asked Ron, out of desperation. Nicole closed her eyes and shook her head. She knew the right thing to do would be to tell Savannah everything she'd learned at the earliest opportunity. She reasoned it must have been hard enough for Savannah to come to terms with her unborn child being the product of rape. But if she then discovered the rapist was a man she'd lived under the same roof with, how much tougher would that be to digest? From recent experience, Nicole was aware how devastating it felt to be deceived by someone you know. And Savannah appeared so pragmatic over impending motherhood and her new life with Jane that Nicole made a snap decision. Savannah was better off being kept in the dark. For now, at least. Meanwhile, Ron felt close to tears, an alien emotion as he awaited Nicole's response.
"I know what you can do," she eventually replied, "and you need to do it tonight."
Chapter 83
"Guys, that's not a good idea! Guys! Guys!"
shouted a marshal through a megaphone as a handful of young people ran towards the ocean at Santa Monica to go skinny dipping. Paik watched as two lifeguards approached the water's edge and shone powerful torches on the naked figures larking around in the waves. He didn't bother to double-check if they were watching when he sparked up a joint with his cigarette lighter.
"Go on spare?"
asked Nicole.
"Sure,"
replied Paik, and handed Nicole a ready-rolled joint from his back pocket.
"It's a good turnout," she continued,
lighting it and taking a long drag.
Sure is. Want to join me in a toast?
She continued, and held up her beer cup to Paik's. Paik nodded.
Aren't you going to ask me what we're toasting?
Let me see, he replied, pretending to think.
Ah, to you buying the hostel from Ron.
Nicole's eyes opened wide.
How could you possibly know that?
Just an hour earlier, she had taken Ron's bank details and promised to wire him a fair price for the hostel in due course. On the proviso, he left there and then. With his options limited, he had little choice but to agree. As Ron crammed his belongings into the back of his car, Nicole hailed a taxi and headed towards the beach party with a renewed sense of purpose.
I may walk around stoned most of the time, but nothing escapes me,
Paik replied.
Apparently so, and don't think too badly of Ron. He doesn't rationalize like us.
Nicole paused to make sure Paik had just said what she thought he'd said.
What? You know what he did to Savannah, and you didn't tell her.
The supreme lesson of human consciousness is to learn how not to know. That is, how not to interfere. The Edge Lawrence.
Nicole frowned.
In other words, Paik continued, Ron will suffer for what he's done, with or without my interference. He will never get to meet his child, watch him grow up, see his own eyes reflected in another's, or be able to love or be loved unconditionally. And that's worth toasting.
Paik clipped Nicole's cup with his own and wandered away, leaving a coil of smoke unspooling behind him. Chapter 84 Matty had never felt a tiredness like the one he felt that night. He glanced wistfully across a beach illuminated by bonfires, lanterns, coloured lights, glow sticks, and the red tips of cigarettes. Every so often Declan turned away from the girl he was flirting with to check on his friend, and Matty would force his eyelids to remain open and offer a reassuring wave. But as soon as Declan's attention was diverted, they fluttered to a close. All he wanted was to fall asleep and wake up in the body of someone else.
"Everything all right, my friend?"
asked Paik, throwing himself onto the sand cross-legged.
"Yeah, just watching my boy in action,"
Matty whispered. "So you've said your goodbyes, then?"
Matty looked quizzically at Paik.
"Yeah, I have,"
he eventually replied. Paik nodded and continued to stare ahead of them both.
"Does he know?"
"No." "He's having a laugh, and I reckon it'll be the last time for a while. I don't want to take that away from him."
"Would you like some company?"
Matty considered it for a moment, but decided he was happy being on his own. He began to understand why Levi, his mother's cat, had taken herself away to die alone in a neighbor's garage. There was something quite empowering about doing it on your own terms, and leaving the world in the same manner in which you arrived.
"I appreciate the offer, but I'm good."
"It's been a pleasure,"
said Paik, rising to his feet and shaking Matty's limp hand.
"Likewise. Explain to Declan for me. Tell him...
"He knows, Matthew. Don't worry about that."
Matty and Paik smiled at each other, and by the time Paik was out of sight, Matty's eyes were already closed. Chapter 85 As pop music made way for classic rap and old-school hip-hop, Nicole left the group of French students she'd been dancing with and was making her way towards the shore when she spotted Tommy. She'd only had 3 cups of beer, but combined with her first joint since her college student nursing days, she felt giddy. It was medicinal, she told herself, and it had certainly stopped her feeling the bruising on her ribs when she moved. But the expression on Tommy's face soon sobered her up.
"You look like you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders," she began.
Tommy didn't reply.
"Savannah's moved out for hostel,"
Nicole persevered.
"I think she's going to be really happy at Jane's place. Did you know she was pregnant?"
Tommy shook his head but said nothing.
Have I upset you, Tommy?
No, he replied. Not everything's about you.
That's unfair,
Nicole replied, offended by his offhand attitude.
Is it Jake? I know you two are...
Jake and I are nothing,
Tommy interrupted.
Oh, right. I saw him heading towards the beer tent a few minutes ago, if you're interested.
When Tommy offered no reply, Nicole decided against telling him about her hostel acquisition and began to walk away before halting.
Tommy, please talk to me. You're worrying me.
If you see Jake, tell him to meet me on the pier. He'll know where.
But before Nicole could respond, Tommy had the bright lights of the fairground in his sights. Chapter 86. The Ferris wheel offered panoramic views across Santa Monica's coastline, way beyond the commercial shopping area, and up and along Route 66. Mechanical failure had temporarily shut the roller coaster, so all four corners of the 9-acre pier were eerily quiet long before its midnight curfew. From its furthest end, Tommy heard the grinding mechanism slowly moving the giant wheel as the tide below crashed against the pier's wooden stilts. He stood with his back to the rides, staring at the blinking orange lights on buoys bobbing alongside the ocean's current.
"You're a hard man to track down,"
began Jake, approaching Tommy from behind. He placed his hand on Tommy's shoulder, then let it fall towards the arch of his back and held it there.
"Why are you up here on your own, when the party's down there?"
"I used to love fairgrounds,"
began Tommy, staring straight ahead of him.
"My parents would take me and my brothers when it came to Abington Park every summer. Lee won me a goldfish at one of those hoop stalls. 11 years later, and it's still alive. Unbelievable, isn't it? For 11 years it's been swimming around in circles, day in, day out, all on its own."
"I didn't think goldfish lived that long."
"It's outlived Lee and Dan."
Jake paused. "Is that who you meant when you said you'd lost people close to you?" Tommy fell silent.
"Do you want to tell me about them? It might help."
"I think you've done enough already."
"What's that supposed to mean?" asked Jake, but didn't get his answer. They remained in a stilted silence before frustration got the better of him. "Why are you pushing me away, Tommy?" he snapped. "You're acting like a kid. I'm old enough to accept rejection, so just be honest with me."
"Be honest?" Tommy laughed. "Do you remember when you said there was a connection between us? Well, you're right, there is."
"Okay, but that doesn't explain why..."
"Not a connection in the way you think,"
Tommy interrupted.
"I don't understand."
"You talk about honesty, Jake, but just how honest are we with each other? The night you arrived and we went out for coffee, we agreed one of the best things about travelling is that you get to hear a complete stranger's life story. Well, we're long past being strangers, but we don't know the first thing about each other, do we? So do you want me to start?"
Jake nodded, puzzled by the ire slowly warping Tommy's face.
"I came travelling when my family fell apart after my brothers were killed in a car accident."
Jake paused and squinted at Tommy, unsure of how his story related to him. Suddenly Tommy turned and looked Jake straight in the eye.
"You sure you don't know where this is going, Stuart?"
The look of alarm, hastily spreading across his face, told them both Jake knew exactly where this was going. 2 years earlier, London. As Stuart left Jerry Garland's house, the only thing he had any control over was her car, courtesy of the keys he'd grabbed when her security men were more concerned with bundling him out of her house. Stealing her Range Rover was a tiny victory against the woman who'd systematically built him up, then torn him down. As he fought his way through the congested London traffic and towards the M1, Stuart was acutely aware he could never take back the events of the last 18 hours. But he was struggling to come to terms with them. Zack was refusing to answer his phone calls. His lightning strikes bandmates had turned their backs on him, and the woman he loathed had hung him out to dry. Try as he might, he could feel only limited sympathy towards Katie, who'd thrown her hat in the ring with the devil and paid the ultimate price. As much as he hated it, there was only one place where he could retreat and regroup, his former shared house in Bolton. But there was a 3-hour drive ahead of him. And he struggled to focus on the road, so each time the cocaine's effects began wearing off, he took another hit. When the overhead gantry signs warned the motorway ahead was closed at Junction 15, he followed the diversion signs and drove towards an estate called Hunsbury. Then, without warning, Stuart's heart felt like it was beating its way out of his chest. He struggled for breath, his temperature soared and his vision blurred, as he frantically searched for the button to put the electric window down. He stretched his arms out against the steering wheel and tried to regain control of his body. He failed to notice the first red light he passed through, but by the time he'd driven through the second, it was too late to hit the brakes. After being pushed 50 meters along the road, the vehicle Stuart ploughed into finally came to a rest on its side, almost broken in two by an equally broken man. Stuart felt a shooting pain tear up his nostrils and spread across his temples when the airbag deployed and caught his face full on. But Jerry's bulky 4x4 offered him much more protection than the vehicle he'd collided with, which lay in the road like a crumpled concertina. He blindly fumbled around to unclip his seatbelt and struggled to find the handle to open his door. He staggered outside, his legs almost buckling beneath him. Stuart stared in horror at the carnage before him, struck by the gravity of his actions. He remained motionless until he heard voices and turned his head to see figures hurrying towards the scene. It was only then that his survival instinct kicked in, and he knew what he had to do. He pulled his hood up over his head and limped past what was once a mini, glancing through the broken windscreen. He clamped his hand over his mouth when he saw two mangled bodies lying in the front seats, and he could just about make out a third figure in the back of the car, lying motionless but for his blinking eyes. Stuart dry heaved as the voices behind him became louder. Then, with all the strength he could muster, he ran, and he didn't stop running for another 3 years. Chapter 87. Today. What had begun as Declan striving to chat up a girl he didn't know had turned into something quite unexpected, with a familiar face. As he took a break from flirting with the girl Matty had pointed out, Declan trudged across the sand to check on his friend, and bumped into a fellow hosteler. They'd seen each other around the building many times, and had enjoyed brief conversations, but the beach was the first place either of them had taken any time to do more than exchange pleasantries. The conversation flowed naturally, without Declan relying on his tried-and-tested lines, jokes and flattery. And he became slowly aware that he was winning her over simply by being himself. For the first time in a long time, if ever, Declan found himself making plans to meet a girl the next morning for breakfast, rather than waking up with her. Nicole was feeling the same way. Butterflies only circled her stomach when something awful loomed. But now, chatting to Declan, their wings felt lighter. Their easygoing repartee came as a welcome distraction from Eric's betrayal, Ruth's breakdown, and Tommy's mood swings. Declan made her laugh, at a time when she'd have been well within her rights to cry until Christmas. With plans made, Declan traipsed towards Matty with a spring in his step.
"Lazy bollocks. You'll never guess who I've been gassing with," he began, and sat down beside his friend.
Declan couldn't take his eyes off Nicole as she chatted to another hosteler, occasionally looking over to him but pretending she wasn't.
"That Nicole girl, Tommy's mate. She's a bit special, that one. Do you hear me?"
When Matty didn't acknowledge him, Declan turned to see him lying on his back, his head resting on a folded blanket, and his eyes snapped tightly shut. Declan turned his head again to stare at the party in front of them.
"Hey! Sleepyhead,
Let's get you home.
Even as the words tripped from his mouth, Declan knew Matty had left him. For a full minute he remained as lifeless as his friend, processing the fact that the inevitable had arrived. Then, gently, he placed Matty's hand into the palm of his own and stared up into the night sky as a fireworks display illuminated them in whites, greens, and oranges. "I'm not ready," Declan whispered. "I'm still not ready." Chapter 88.
Stuart.
Tommy pronounced such a simple word with such venomous precision. There was no doubt in Jake's mind his cover was blown, but he didn't want to admit it.
"No, that's not possible,"
Jake muttered, his muscular shoulders dropping by the weight of his shame.
"It is, Stuart, believe me. I am walking, talking proof that it is possible."
Jake took two steps back, and with wide-open eyes he glared at Tommy, hoping to find something in his friend's expression that revealed this was some kind of sick prank. But there was nothing but abhorrence etched deeply into Tommy's face.
"How did you find out?"
One day earlier, Venice Beach, in desperate need of solitude, in a city of noise, Tommy slipped Jose a bag of weed and locked himself in the store cupboard of the hot dog trailer. The 10-foot by 10-foot room was windowless and reeked of cheap Frankfurters, but it was air-conditioned and, most importantly, quiet. Tommy felt like someone had used his head as a football, leaving his thoughts jumbled and nonsensical. The dark clouds were rolling in as everything he thought he knew about Jake was in flux. He removed his iPhone from his pocket and waited for a signal to appear. Then he skipped through his photos until he found the one with Jake's torso tattoos on display. Then, making a mental note of the final coordinates, he typed 52.2189N and 0.9202W into the search engine. He watched carefully as they threw up the location of where Jake's journey had begun. Hunsbury, Northampton. The place where Tommy's life changed with the speed of the car that smashed into him. The tarmac graveyard where his brothers were killed, and he was left to die. Where Stuart Reynolds ceased to exist, and the journey of Jake Bellamy began. A strangely calm Tommy took the memory card he had until now refused to view and placed it inside his camcorder. His finger hovered above a button. Then he closed his eyes and braced himself before he pressed play. First came what he'd recorded as their car drove through the streets of Northampton, and goosebumps bubbled across his arms upon hearing the voices of his brothers teasing him about porn websites they knew he secretly surfed. Then came their words of encouragement about finding a job. And Tommy knew what was coming next. The footage was shaky, as his camera had flown around the car upon impact, and then the screen turned black. Tommy sat in silence, recalling the smells of broken fluid pipes, the sharpness of glass crunching beneath his legs, and the sounds of panicked onlookers outside. He remembered the confusion over what had just happened before he realized Lee and Daniel's fate. He hadn't noticed he'd closed his eyes until a noise brought him back to his senses. He thought someone else was in the room, before noticing the camcorder hadn't stopped recording that day. It must have landed somewhere near to him on the back seat, he thought. And when he'd moved, it had sprung back to life, the autofocus settling on the shattered windscreen. At first he heard the concerned voices of witnesses in the distance. Then slowly he watched as a figure, a face mainly shadowed by a hoodie, slowly limped past the car. Tommy rewound the footage and watched it again, and then pressed pause. When he zoomed in, Stuart and Jake's bloody face filled the screen. Today.
We looked at each other, do you remember?
Continued Tommy.
You were running away from the mini when suddenly you turned around. And just for a split second we made eye contact. Then, puff, you disappeared, just like that.
In rare moments when Jake's subconscious caught him off guard, he recalled the moment that altered the course of his life with such clarity. It was like yesterday. Then, in the days that followed as he plotted starting his life anew in a succession of cheap hotel rooms, he'd turn the television off and avoid newspaper pages when confronted by the names and faces of those he killed, so as not to risk humanizing them. Tommy, Jake began, his eyes having conceded defeat, but Tommy wasn't prepared to listen.
It was a journalist who tipped us off that the police were looking at you in connection with the crash, but the police refused to confirm it, even after you supposedly died. I remembered seeing you on TV the morning of the accident. They said you had something to do with the death of that soap star. I mean, I knew who you and your shitty band were anyway, but I'd never really taken much notice of you. And hard as they tried, the police couldn't find any concrete proof it was your fault. Your fingerprints were all over that car, so it should have been a no-brainer. But there was never any evidence you were behind the wheel that day. Your manager refused to confirm you'd stolen it. There was no footage of you on CCTV, no blood or DNA on the airbag. And no you. They couldn't even question you because you'd vanished. And then, when they told us it looked like you'd killed yourself, everyone thought it was something to do with that girl dying. The police never named you as a suspect in our crash, so you got away with it. But I knew who you were and what you did. And even hearing one of your songs like the one the girls were dancing to on the Xbox game made me so angry.
Jake brushed his hand through his hair and rubbed his cheeks. He'd spent the last few years learning how to organize his thoughts and place those that frightened him to the back of his mind. He'd explored a multitude of religions and belief systems. He'd learned from teachers and seers and read books and pamphlets, all to help him understand how to move forward and turn his back on the reckless stupidity of his actions. His ribs were inked with the coordinates of every location he'd seen, to remind him of how far he had travelled, both physically and spiritually. And just when he'd forgiven himself for his actions and found the peace he craved, his past and his present were colliding with the speed of a runaway freight train.
"I was obsessed with you at first," Tommy continued. "I must have surfed 1,000 pictures of your face to try and work out if it was you I saw while I was trapped in the back of the car. I could never be 100% sure, but my gut instinct was that it was you. I hated you. In fact, hated is probably too much of an understatement. But your suicide, well, that made the pain ease a little. Not much, mind. But eventually it was just about enough to help me crawl out of my hole and start trying to live my life again. Only now I find out you're not just alive, but that you and I... We've... Shit, I can't even say it. Now you've made me hate both of us, not just you."
Jake swallowed hard, his arms and legs trembling with Tommy's every word. Eventually, when he thought Tommy was ready to listen, he spoke. "I'm sorry. Tommy, I'm so, so sorry," he began. "I need you to understand. I was a different person then. I was so fucked up. I'd lost everything I'd ever worked for. I was at such a low point I wasn't thinking straight. When that accident happened, I panicked and I didn't know what to do."
"So what you chose to do was to run away. You killed my brothers and then you ran away."
"People on the street were coming to help you. I saw them, that's why I left. There was nothing I could do."
"But you didn't know that for certain, did you, Stuart?"
Jake's lips parted, and he wanted to defend his actions, but he knew he couldn't.
"That's what I thought,"
continued Tommy, before raising his fist and catching Jake clean on the jaw. Chapter 89. Savannah dreamed she was floating, somewhere between the bed in her new home and the ceiling above her. She felt her body drift through the door, turn mid-air above the landing and gradually descend the stairs. but when she felt two arms supporting her back and legs, she understood she wasn't floating. She was being carried. She opened her eyes, but the walls surrounding her swirled like water slipping down a plug hole. Her lips and throat felt parched, and when she tried to speak, she could only hear herself mumble. Instantly, she likened the feeling to when she stumbled out of the club and into the path of Paik's car, and a new terror began to rip through her. But her body was too sedated to spring back into life. Savannah was lugged across the hallway, but there was a pause when she reached the lounge. Through her misty eyes, she thought she saw Jane, sitting on a wooden chair with something covering the smile Savannah had found so kindly. Something wasn't right, and when her eyes slowly began to focus, she quickly realized Jane's mouth had been gagged, and her arms and feet bound to the wicker chair legs. Scared, Savannah desperately wanted to kick and punch the person carrying her, but her limbs barely twitched. However, it was enough to make the person whose arms held her notice the dead weight he was lifting was reviving. "It's okay, Savvy. I'm gonna get you out of here," a male voice whispered. Savannah's tired eyes slowly widened. She looked down at his strong, bare brown arms, and then up towards his face.
"Michael,"
she mouthed, and felt the familiar warmth of his breath as he carried her out of the front door, down the path, and towards his brown station wagon that had been parked out of view for much of the day. Chapter 90. Jake staggered backwards and clutched the jaw Tommy had just whacked. Tommy clasped his fist with his other hand, in obvious pain, but trying hard to disguise it. Jake began to pace up and down, hoping the movement would jolt his thoughts back into a normal running order. "What happened happened, and there hasn't been a day that's gone by where I haven't prayed to God it hadn't," Jake offered, his palm still clenched to his face. "You don't know how bad I feel." Tommy narrowed his eyes and laughed.
"How bad you feel, Stuart? Really? So this is about how you feel, is it?"
No, that's not what I meant," continued Jake, closing his eyes, and growing frustrated with himself. "Tommy, Stuart Reynolds died as well that day. I don't want to be the person I was then, and I'm not, I swear to you, I'm not. You know me, the real me.
The real you's a coward who thinks a couple of months in a Buddhist temple means he's absolved of all his sins. When newsflash, Stuart, you're not. It's nowhere near enough."
Suddenly, Jake's emotions got the better of him, and his eyes became watery.
"Tommy, please,"
he begged and put his hand on Tommy's arm.
"Take that off me, or so help me God, I will kill you. I understand why you're upset."
"You have no idea what I am."
When Tommy felt Jake's fingers grip him tighter, Tommy pushed him hard in the shoulder. Desperate to prove to Tommy his sincerity, Jake tried to hold Tommy's arm again, but Tommy punched him hard on the side of his face. Jake lost his balance and fell to the ground as Tommy winced at the pain in his knuckles and fingers.
"Why did you run away?"
yelled Tommy.
"Why did you just leave us?"
"I wasn't thinking straight," continued Jake, pulling himself up to his feet. "I didn't think there was anything I could do to help."
"You couldn't know that because you didn't stay to find out."
Oh, no. But, Tommy, we can work our way through this. It won't be easy, but I really believe we can if you just try. You have to give me a chance."
"You know what the most pathetic thing about all of this is, Stuart?"
Tommy wiped his eyes and sniffed up the mucus dripping from his nostrils.
"Me. I'm the most pathetic thing because I thought if I couldn't be you, then maybe I could be with you. How fucking stupid is that? That I wanted to be with the person who destroyed my family."
"It's not too late. I promise you."
Tommy shook his head and glared at Jake. It said everything he needed to say, but he felt no better. Jake's explanation hadn't made a blind bit of difference. and Tommy knew he must walk away now or risk his anger getting the better of him. As he began to leave, Jake grabbed hold of his arm one last time, and it was all that was needed to tip Tommy over the edge. Tommy hit Jake again, missing his face and catching his neck. Jake staggered backwards, and Tommy's second blow caught him on the bridge of his nose. Both of them heard the bone pop. Neither the noise nor the pain in Tommy's fist stopped him from raining more blows on Jake's head, as his adversary attempted to shield himself with his forearms. Jake refused to retaliate, and staggered backwards into the railings while Tommy continued on autopilot, unleashing every drop of wrath and ferocity his body possessed, until it was close to empty. There they remained, rooted to the floorboards of the pier, exhausted, battered, bruised, and breathing heavily before Jake finally spoke. "I love you, Tommy," he pleaded. One final blow to the side of Jake's head was all it took for him to topple backwards off the pier and into the choppy waters below. Chapter 91 "He's dead," came a voice in a measured tone. Tommy stopped in his tracks and turned around slowly to see Declan staring at the words "Welcome to Wherever You Are" on the poster in the hostel reception before him. Tommy's mind raced 10 to the dozen, trying to figure out how Declan could have known what had happened between him and Jake on the pier. "He's dead," repeated Declan. "It wasn't what it looked like," Tommy replied carefully. "It was an accident." "He was my best mate." Tommy paused. "I don't understand." "Matty's gone. He's dead."
"Oh, Christ, I'm sorry."
Tommy felt a combination of relief that his secret was safe and sympathy for Declan's loss. The diversity of Venice Beach's occupants and visitors made the unusual usual, so nobody who passed Declan carrying Matty's body over his shoulder along the boardwalk even gave the friends a second glance. Once Declan had returned Matty to the security of the hostel and carefully laid him on his bed, he was at a loss as to what to do next, so he ventured through the silent corridors and back towards reception. There he slumped to the floor and leant against a wall, entwining the fingers of both his hands together like he was in prayer. He fixated on the poster's words, and knew that without Matty by his side, Declan had no idea where he was. Meanwhile, Tommy was short of breath, having run the mile and a half from Santa Monica back to Venice, only stopping midway to prop himself up against a parking meter and to vomit into the road. Repeatedly, he replayed the 2 seconds it took for Jake to disappear over the pier's railings, and the heavy sound the water made when his body plunged into it. Tommy squinted into the dark waves below him, horrified by what he'd done, calling Jake's name, not Stuart's, but receiving no response. He sprinted the length of the pier, and then back on himself across the beach, rushing waist-high into the water, shouting for Jake over and again. In desperation, he used the flashlight app on his phone, but it wasn't powerful enough to illuminate more than a couple of meters ahead. And after a frantic 15 minutes or so, he knew it was too late. Tommy hurried back towards the beach party, and his head swept from side to side, hoping against all hope to catch sight of a soaking wet Jake amongst the revelers. But he wasn't anywhere to be seen. Suddenly feeling exposed and vulnerable, Tommy made the decision to return to the hostel. It was only while he ran that Tommy noted the irony of his actions. He had followed the same path as Stuart Reynolds. Rather than face up to a terrible mistake, contact the authorities and suffer the consequences, he'd taken the easy way out and simply run away. Nevertheless, by the time he reached the hostel entrance, he knew he was in too deep and had to clean up the mess he'd created.
"Where's Matty now?"
Tommy asked Declan softly.
"I put him in our room."
"Okay, will you come with me to the lounge, and I'll be back in a minute."
After leading Declan to the sofa, Tommy made his way up the corridor to remove any trace of Jake from the hostel. He opened a cupboard door and grabbed a roll of plastic bin liners, deciding to hide Jake's belongings in the alley dumpster for the following day's collection. Then he would change the booking register, so it looked like Jake had checked out midway through the beach party and continued with his travels. But as he approached Jake's room, the normally locked door was ajar. Chapter 92. Michael drove the first leg of his journey with Savannah for 6 hours straight, while she slept by his side in the passenger seat. She used the handbag Michael had taken from her room as a pillow, and every so often he placed 2 fingers on her wrist to check her pulse, or turned the radio off just to hear her breathe, a sound he wasn't sure he'd ever hear again after she vanished from his life. When he'd bundled Savannah into his car, he'd briefly but gently informed her that Jane was a private investigator, employed by Savannah's father to track her down, befriend her, and bring her home. Savannah was unsure whether it was that awful information or the sedatives in her bloodstream making her feel queasy. Most people have never been drugged once in their lifetime, she thought. And here she was with 2 incidents under her belt, each with differing end results. A purple and orange patchwork of light began to illuminate the sky as the sun appeared from behind the hills ahead. Michael stretched out his fingers as straight as he could manage. They were healing nicely, he thought, although his orthopedic hand specialist warned him they might never function as fully as they once did. Michael was grateful his university tutors had shown understanding about the car accident that rendered him useless as a potential surgeon, and for them permitting him to change courses when the following semester began. The rush of fresh air coming in through the window finally woke Savannah. She stared at Michael, still in disbelief like a child meeting Father Christmas.
"It's really you," she croaked. "I thought I was dreaming."
"Drink some water," he smiled, and passed her a bottle.
"Where are we going?"
"Well, I figured we could start in Arizona, and we can decide from there." Savannah had so many questions she wasn't sure where to begin.
"How did you know where to find me?"
"Girl, you hid yourself well." Chapter 93. Tommy held his breath and nervously opened the door to Jake's room. Inside it was empty of Jake's belongings, leaving just a stripped bed. Tommy realized Jake must have survived his fall, returned to the hostel before him, and cleared out.
"You're alive," thought Tommy,
and let out a long sigh of relief. He covered his face with his hands, rubbed his sore eyes, and let out a deep breath. Tommy had teased Jake for being a neatness freak, and always keeping his belongings packed away in his rucksack. But now he understood Jake was preparing for a moment just like this, for when his past and his present collided, and he needed to escape them both. Tommy's eyes looked around the room for any trace of Jake, and focused on an open locker. From inside he removed a silver bracelet and a scrap of paper. "What we are never changes, Tommy," it read. "But who we are never stops changing. Remember me better than I am. Jake." As much as he hated Stuart Reynolds, a significant part of Tommy was already missing Jake. Now he understood that Stuart's death wouldn't have brought him any closer to closure, but Jake Bellamy's purpose in Tommy's life was to help set Tommy free. But in doing so, it meant Jake had chosen to keep running, forever trapped in a moment of madness from his past. Tommy turned the bracelet over and read the engraving. "Don't look back." He wouldn't, he promised himself. Then he slipped the bracelet onto his wrist, to remind himself how one reckless moment can change everything you thought you knew about yourself. Twenty minutes after Tommy dialed 911, an ambulance arrived outside the hostel's entrance to take Matty's body away to Santa Monica's UCLA Medical Center. Declan followed the stretcher, on which his friend's body lay, from their room along the corridor, down the stairs and into the back of the vehicle. Many of the other guests who'd returned from the beach party quickly sobered up at the sight and stood in a silent line of respect as one of their own embarked on his final journey. Chapter 94. Savannah couldn't take her eyes off Michael as he drove. The only thing that looked different about him was a concave scar in the center of his forehead. And she shuddered when she recalled the sound her father's mallet had made when it collided with Michael's skull. She listened intently as Michael drove and explained how he'd searched for her everywhere he could think of, back in Montgomery, Alabama. But to no avail. Then, just when he was about to reluctantly give up, he received an unexpected email from Savannah's sister, Rosanna. He agreed to meet the desperate-sounding girl in a busy shopping center, where she tearfully revealed everything she knew about the whereabouts of her sister in Los Angeles, gleaned from flirting with one of her father's young assistants. The boy explained that Reverend Devereux had put up a $250,000 reward to find his daughter, and several private detective agencies were fighting to be the first to bring her home. They'd all begun at the Montgomery Greyhound station, where she'd purchased a bus ticket to L.A. using his credit card. There were more than 400 hotels of varying size in the city, and with her father freezing her bank accounts, her hunters assumed all Savannah had in her possession was the money she'd stolen from his wallet, and as that wouldn't stretch far, she'd need a place to stay that was basic and affordable. That narrowed the field down to around 120 motels. One agency's team was deployed to the city to visit all the cheap dives and bolt holes, armed with photographs of the missing Savannah, but with no success. Another hired a personality profiler, who normally tracked down serial killers, to build up a picture of her likely pattern of behavior, based on her hobbies, talents, skills, and qualifications, and a need to keep a low profile. They narrowed her potential line of work down to 3 cash-in-hand jobs, where few questions were asked. Waitress, prostitute, or exotic dancer. And at the Flesh for Fantasy strip club, they'd found their target. The Reverend showed no loyalty to any of those hunting his kin, and was happy to pass on updates from one detective agency to another. One tried the softly-softly approach and paid one of Savannah's colleagues a $1,000 tip to drug her water bottle with Rohypnol. But when Savannah realized something didn't feel right, she hurriedly left the changing room and then fell into the path of a stranger's car. The next morning, Savannah had disappeared, quitting her job. It took 4 more weeks before another detective located her, dancing at the Pink Pussycat Club and residing in a backpacking hostel. Savannah constantly surrounded herself with people either at work or in the hostel, making her a hard target to pick off. But Reverend Devereux was an impatient man, and sent his own team, all guns blazing, to swipe his daughter from the street. No one involved anticipated that Savannah might be armed, and just how ready she was to fight back. So when that plan backfired, a persuasive British private detective heard on the grapevine about the bounty, and asked the Reverend to give her a chance. And when he agreed, Janet Davies became Jane Doherty. She wormed her way into Savannah's life with a fabricated backstory and a plan to befriend the girl, win her trust, and lure her out of her comfort zone. "Your dad got wind that Rosanna was seeing his employee and fired him," continued Michael. "So hearing Jane had that day just moved into your room in the hostel was the last piece of information your sister could get, and I never heard from her again." Savannah shook her head, worried about her sister, and feeling foolish and gullible for desperately wanting to trust Jane. "It's okay," Michael reassured her, sensing Savannah's sadness. "You weren't to know." Michael explained he'd arrived in Los Angeles 6 days earlier, and begun following Savannah and Jane from a safe distance, waiting for the moment when he could approach his girlfriend on her own and lead her to safety. On several occasions he considered just bursting his way into the hostel and finding Savannah. But he couldn't be sure if Jane was working alone. When Michael followed Jane to the house in West Hollywood, he contacted the real estate